27th, 7:00 PM, and we're going to go ahead and start the planning board meeting. Before we start, can we do Pledge of Allegiance, Board Member Hum?
Yeah, happy to do so.
Thank you.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, thank you for leading us, and with that, we'll begin the meeting officially with roll call.
Good evening. Board Member Sue?
Here.
Board Member Hum?
Here.
Board Member Saheba?
Present.
And President Cisneros?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum and three absences, Board Member Ariza, Ruiz, and Wang.
Great. Moving on to agenda changes. Anything from staff or?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. And let me just. Okay, moving on to non-agenda public comment. Anyone can speak for 3 minutes for an item that's not agendized for tonight?
We have no speakers.
No speakers? Okay, great. We'll go ahead and close that item. And moving on to consent calendar, we have draft meeting minutes for May 12th. And we also have item 5A, which is the general plan conformance with the capital improvement plan, I believe. So folks here have any comments, if not a motion?
Is 5A consent or, oh, okay, it should be labeled 4B then?
Yes, just to clarify, so it was 5A under the regular calendar. In error, we can move it to what you described as 4B. Same item, it's a consent item.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that, that clarification. So, right, any comments? If not, any emotion? The consent calendar, I think, won't we open it after the motion?
No.
We do before?
You need public comment before you make a motion.
Oh, thank you. Do we have any public comments? All right, now we'll go ahead and close public comment. And now do we have a motion?
I'll need to abstain from the minutes. I wasn't at that meeting.
Okay.
Okay, so then we don't have a quorum for that particular meeting.
Oh.
Okay, so we'll keep it on until the next meeting.
Yes.
Great. All right, can we make a motion for the general plan conformance item?
Yes, that would be good.
Okay. Is there?
I move adoption of, I guess, item 4B for the general plan's conformance.
I will second.
Great, motion is second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Oppose, abstentions, we have three absent.
Thank you.
Great. All right, and with that, we'll go ahead and move to regular agenda items, which first item here is inclusionary housing update workshop.
I'm just going to move over here because it's maybe more comfortable. But so, good evening. I'm Steve Buckley. I'm the Planning Services Manager, and I'll be making a brief presentation, introduction, really. And then I'll be handing it over to our consultant. So Kirsten Dischinger is here with Street Level Advisors. She's on the Zoom, and she works with Rick Jacobus, and they were our consultants on this project thus far. We contracted them to advise us on policy as well as some of the financials that they're very familiar with in terms of inclusionary housing, affordable housing development, and market rate housing, and how those all sort of synergize if you get your policy right. So this all came about through the housing element, which was adopted and included several implementation items, sort of a to-do list. And we're working our way down that list. As you know, we've brought you several different ordinance amendments and policy discussions. This one in particular is to refine the sort of rental and ownership housing in terms of both the percentage of inclusionary, the pricing that would be targeted with those different inclusionary programs, as well as a possible in-lieu fee that would be an alternative to the on-site units. The other option to on-site units is to have a clustered development where a developer partners, say, between a market rate and a nonprofit or the housing authority to develop a separate lot or building with the affordable units that, which are then supported through on-site services and other funding sources. As you know, we formed a working group a while back and met several times with staff from the Housing Authority and Housing and Human Services Department. So Sylvia Martinez and Simone Falls were engaged in each of those meetings, and we had a couple of you attend several of those meetings. And my takeaway was that we have a really good program. You know, we have great development partners in the Housing Authority. We have great regulatory partners in Housing and Human Services. We're just trying to sort of optimize the inclusionary part. And as I said, the in-lieu fee option, given that the housing element found that there's maybe a disconnect between the rental and the ownership programs. And Kirsten will get into that a little bit more. She'll also provide you a little bit more comparison to other cities and some of the findings or recommendations. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to her, and then we'll be available for questions.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Steve, who controls the slides?
I'll do the slides.
Great. Good evening, everyone. Kirsten Dissinger. Thanks, Steve, for that great introduction. As Steve said, I'm here tonight to really summarize what we covered in the working group and what our team, Street Level Advisor, were able to bring to the group in terms of trends and best practices. And then I'll review the recommendations that were discussed in our report and the case report. To start with, I'm going to look, I think we want to skip ahead a couple slides. Yeah. I'm going to present some trends, both national and regional, in inclusionary housing programs. And we're drawing from a survey nationally that was completed in 2019. So that's some older data. And from the local and regional, we're drawing from data from 2024, which is very recent. I do want to flag that all of the stuff I'm going to be talking about for the Bay Area and Alameda County was data collected by MTC, self-reported by the jurisdictions prior to them doing any of their housing element rezoning or implementation measures. So just like you're considering today, many jurisdictions throughout the Bay Area are considering small to large changes to their inclusionary program. So just keep that in mind when you're looking at these baseline data. So the first thing really is about who to serve and how much affordable housing you can require. Nationally, the households that are targeted are 50 to 80% AMI by almost all the programs. This makes a lot of sense because of the nature of the program and the history of the program, you know, how it dovetails well with other more deeply affordable programs and kind of ends up being the top of many jurisdictions' affordability ladders. You'll see that some jurisdictions offer, require inclusionary units or target households above that 80% AMI. Those are probably the higher cost jurisdictions where there's still affordability issues at those higher income brackets. If we take a look at the next slide, zooming in on the Bay Area, you'll see that most jurisdictions focus on this 50 to 80% AMI again. There's a few programs, about a quarter of them, that go up to 120% AMI. And for those are mostly in the higher cost areas like Marin or some of the southern jurisdictions in Silicon Valley. So zooming in on Alameda County, however, that 50% and 50 or 60% and 80% AMI sort of target is pretty consistent. You see there's only two jurisdictions, Alameda, City of Alameda, yourselves in Dublin, that offer or require inclusionary rental units above 80% AMI. And we'll get into a little more about why that is. Thank you. And I just want to say, like, I do think that a lot of jurisdictions are looking at these requirements. So again, everything you're seeing is like 2 years ago or 1 year ago. But for ownership, generally those programs serve the 80 to the 120. That's really the most common. In Marin, we saw some programs that went up to 135% for home ownership. Of course, the cost of home ownership and the cost of rental in Marin is so much higher that that kind of bump up makes sense. It's really important to get a program that actually can, you know, serves folks that can't be served in the private market, and that's really easy for home ownership in the Bay Area, but it still remains very hard for households to get into ownership, even when the price point is at their affordability level for some lower income households. Other barriers come up like down payment assistance and HOA. So we're seeing a lot of the programs kind of don't go very far below 80% AMI. And then in Alameda County, you'll see that most programs are at the 80 and 120. Only two programs, including the City of Alameda, reach below 80% AMI for ownership. Great. In lieu fees, so you guys currently just charge in lieu, allow in lieu fees for smaller projects. So just taking a look at what happens with in lieu fees in the Bay Area, nearly every jurisdiction offers that option to developers so they could build the units or provide, pay the fee. Most are on a square foot basis. The reason I don't have a table or chart in front of you about the fees is most jurisdictions have multiple fee rates for different projects based on their tenure or their building type or their geography. Like some neighborhoods, the fee can be higher or lower. And there are some jurisdictions that have 12 or 20 different fee rates. They can get very complex. Those fee rates are based on financial feasibility, and also most jurisdictions try and make that fee rate either exactly equivalent to the cost of on-site or slightly higher if they really want the on-site, or slightly lower if they really want the fee, but generally close or proximate to that. And so that's why you'd see a variation across different factors. And again, the fee rates vary broadly, even in Alameda County. I saw one jurisdiction that charged $17 a square foot on some projects, and then up to 55 or 60 for other types of projects, and then a large range in between. And then this is just, you know, I think you don't have a big fee program right now, and there can be some, there's generally jurisdictions prefer or guide programs towards the on-site unit production because it gets you the unit, it's integrated with the market rate, it's delivered on the same time, all the beautiful things we love about inclusionary. I just want to call out, there's a lot of amazing things that you can do to really fill out your affordable housing program with the in-lieu fee. The best practice would be to use it to leverage other state dollars in your 100% affordable project. So if you have a big enough flow of in-lieu fees, you have a lot of development happening, that's a really great use for it. If you're in a context where not a lot of fees are generated, either the market is down or you just have people choosing on-site instead, there's still some really fabulous uses for fees. Steve and I pulled these out of your housing element. These are just a few things of your few of your implementation programs that would be a really good match for like a small movie fund if you ever found yourselves in that place. Okay. So the last place, our last recommendation is about the term of affordability. Currently, you all require the units to be affordable for 59 years, which pretty much tracks with a nationwide trend. But what we're seeing in California and especially the Bay Area is jurisdictions are transitioning to making that requirement for 99 years or for the life of the building. And this is one area where I know that many jurisdictions in the Bay Area are planning to make this change as a result of the six cycle housing element. So I expect this list, when we're back in front of you in a year or so, to be much, much longer. But you see there's nine jurisdictions with that currently having the 99-year term of affordability. Okay. So the next thing we want to do is go over our recommendations. As a reminder, these four recommendations really are coming from both the housing element and then the work of the working group that we convened to really process and understand what needs to be done and how we can just tweak and improve your inclusionary program requirement, your inclusionary program. So there's four recommendations. The first one is about updating the on-site requirements. And there's a fee. And then we'll talk a little bit about improving the cluster agreements. And then finally, the term of affordability. So for the on-site requirements, your program currently requires 15% affordability, 4% at 50, 4% at 80, 7% at 110. The housing element called for an inspection of that, especially talking about how the moderate income rental units are so close to market that there's questions of, are they offering a public good? And then there's questions of, are they able to be filled when tenants might choose to just seek housing in the private market? And we found data in your housing element that sort of backed that assertion up. And so we looked at how could we rejigger the requirement. You'll notice that our recommendation, which is option three, reduces the total amount of affordable units down to 10%. That it can feel shocking, but it also makes sense. If you have seven units of mod income housing that's costing the developer very little to subsidize because the rent they're charging is so close to market that you can't really take that amount and then subsidize a number of 80% or 40% units. So we worked really hard to keep the percentages close to 15% while also trying to keep the overall financial impact or the feasibility of development pretty constant with your current program. And for that reason, we're recommending the 10% at 50, 4% at 50 and 6% at 80. But as you'll see on this table, we explored a number of program options that are all generally consistent with the current feasibility. And so I would expect this board and the community and other decision-making bodies to have a good discussion about which policy outcome is the best match for you all. And I think this menu of options would all be feasible outcomes from a development perspective. For the ownership projects, we looked at moving them all up to that mod. Again, this is about making sure the program matches the user and making sure that, you know, you have units that can be occupied by households. They can access the good. So we found that the cost of complying with your current program is quite astronomical, and most folks were not able to build the on-site 50 and 80% AMI units. So we are recommending that instead of that, you look at a higher percentage of affordability and keeping them all at the mod level. If you were gonna have a decision that you wanted the compliance to track really closely, you would keep it at that 18%, really closely to the fee. However, if you wanted to get just a little bit more affordable housing, you could consider 20% inclusionary. That would be 10 or 15% more cost, but you would get more ownership units. And we're recommending that option. But again, this is a policy discussion for you all. Okay, going on to the fees. Currently, your jurisdiction makes a fee available only for small projects, and we're recommending that you do make a fee available for all project sizes. Again, for the rental product, we're suggesting that $35 per square foot is a good number. It's a number that we think, matching with our recommendation for on-site, it would cost just a little bit more than the current on-site requirement. So you're tilting a little bit towards having folks do on-site, but if you have a developer that's like really committed to doing the fee and wants to do 100% market, it's not going to be cost prohibitive for them to choose the fee. That's a policy discussion for you. We're eager to hear your direction on how you want that sort of comparison to land. Okay. And for the ownership product, we're looking at a fee rate of 35 or 50. Again, the fee rate, it's a little bit, we're doing a lot of comparison for you in this table. You see the double and the triple. That's compared to the current fee rate on small projects. When you compare the 35 and the 50 to the cost of on-site compliance, it's still going to be more affordable. So we think that these, you could even go to the $50 per square foot for ownership products and still have a feasible, viable option for a fee program for developers. And Steve had a little bit of an in his intro, some comments about the cluster option. We learned a lot about how developers have been really attracted to this option in Alameda generally, sometimes in the city proper and sometimes on the base. But this is an option where the developer gives land and resources, but doesn't build the units or just pay a fee directly. And you guys have been really successful and creative in getting affordable housing built and more affordable housing than you might otherwise through this process. We are recommending just some updates and some specific criteria for approving those. We want to make sure that you don't have the problem of so much land that you can't actually compete for the state money you need to get the housing built. So checking in with Health and Human Services, Housing and Human Services, and the Housing Authority before the city makes a decision to accept land, and also thinking about that competitiveness and making sure that the land is a better or equivalent deal to the other compliance options. And finally, again, just simply the term of affordability. So again, we just think we're seeing jurisdictions all across the Bay Area consider this. We've heard from developers, certainly homeownership program, the first sale, the developer is out, so there's no financial impact to anyone if you extend that term of affordability to 99 years or the life of the building. And most market rate developers have told us that they're not looking at the financial picture of 99 years from now, so there isn't going to be an immediate impact on development or the feasibility of development if you extend the term. So those are our four recommendations. I'm very excited to be here and have a great conversation with all of you and here for questions and discussion. I'll hand it back to Steve, who was going to talk through this last slide.
Yeah, I just wanted to have this sort of summary of the overall range of recommendations. You know, these are preliminary recommendations based on our consultant's professional opinion and conversations we've all had and kind of our understanding of the marketplace in Alameda. But there's plenty of room for, you know, considering different variables and options in each of these categories. And we'll obviously be also working with the City Council to get their feedback as well. So we do want to at least hear your thoughts or certainly your questions as well, if you have some.
Great, thank you so much for the presentation and for teeing us up for, I guess we'll start with clarifying questions. Board Member Hahn?
Yeah, I have some question. First of all, I appreciate the analysis. I think it's a very good job, and I appreciate the, I was on the subcommittee with what President Cenaros, and I appreciate that the consultant and staff have been very responsive to the comments received by everyone on the committee. I do have some clarifying questions. Table C16 is listed the fair market rents. What income level are we talking about? It'd be good to clarify that in the table. Are we talking about moderate or low income as far as the fair market, the HUD rents? What are they based on?
Let me pull up the table while we.
Not sure which table is.
Oh, table C-16 on page 4. I think those are the moderate rent levels, but
from the housing element. These are from the housing element, and yeah, so yes.
So what percentage household income does that represent?
The fair market rent.
Yeah.
For HUD. I honestly don't know.
So it seems like it might be the moderate, or is it the 80% or the 120?
I believe that would be 60% because that's a Section 8 fair market rent.
Is that what it is? 60%?
I believe so. Yeah.
It'd be good to clarify that at the table.
Okay.
Because that would be helpful. Let's see. I just have a comment, question. This is just a clarifying question. It's not that, probably not that significant, but in figure 1 on page 8, where you compare, different categories, U.S., California, and Massachusetts, I'm just curious why Massachusetts in the 51 to 80%, why there's such a large blue bar? Is it just that there's so many little small townships or something?
Yeah, if I could share, which I can't right off the top of my head, but I'll certainly circulate to you guys a map of the programs across the country, and you'll see that New Jersey, Massachusetts, and California have the most density of programs and the highest frequency. And part of it is like policy history. There's also a number of states in the nation that have bans or limitations on inclusionary, whereas those three states rely heavily on inclusionary housing.
So if I've been reading it right, does that mean, I mean, the reading like the California, you know, is that dark blue bar, it's a pretty small bar, but the bar for Massachusetts is huge, is larger than all of the U.S. So I'm kind of wondering why is that? That doesn't seem
to. Oh, sorry. This is a survey of jurisdictions that have inclusionary, and so they're just talking about of the 209 jurisdictions or however many, couple thousand that answered it, what percent of them are from Massachusetts or the number of programs. So you see there's like 200 programs in Massachusetts that have 50 to 80 for rental. So that's telling you that there's 200 jurisdictions in Massachusetts that have inclusionary that answered the question and also have that AMI.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Must be all these little small townships because Massachusetts is, relatively tiny, especially compared to California. Okay. Thanks for. One question I had, and I think this came up in the prior Planning Commission discussion, and I'm really thinking about the ownership housing. Did you explore the share equity model and what other cities may have done? Because I know there's been debates in the past about, 100%, affordable requirements, or some cities consider a share equity model to allow for accumulation of wealth with the argument that they could gain some of the advantages of a typical, homeowner that buys a market rate housing. So did you explore that option and have any thoughts about that model?
Yeah, we didn't explore the shared equity option here. We were really focused, as you recall, on the tasks identified in the housing element. I would say that there are jurisdictions that sometimes, I think the question you're asking is, you have a home ownership program, there's a spectrum of delivering that. It could be pure equity building and you give all the wealth to the first homeowner. I don't think there's many jurisdictions that do that. Or it could be pure affordability where there's not a lot of equity grown over time for the homeowner. And most programs land somewhere in the middle. And we've seen a lot of jurisdictions get to that, not by exploring sort of a new model of building it or a limited equity, but in their pricing formula and their resale pricing formula, they're able to say how much equity a household can accrue and be more generous or keep more price controlled based on that piece.
I'll just say, we could ask Simone Falls for more information on that, but we do have the regulatory program guidelines as well, and I believe there is a component of the resale equity share.
Oh, it would be good to understand what that is, and in light of the fact that there's a proposal to maybe extend the term of the affordability level to 99 years of ownership versus maybe it's now about 30 years or so, you know. Maybe mm-hmm. after a certain number of years, there could be a shared equity if the homeowner holds onto the property long enough. Mm-hmm. Just a thought out there. And then just kind of one clarification regarding figure two, recent housing feasibility studies. Just to let you know, San Mateo County, the Grand Nexus study, I'm part of the 21 Elements working group for that. They haven't actually published their inclusionary housing ordinance. I think the thought was March was or are you talking about a study that was done in 2016, a really old one then?
Yeah, so the dates are kind of off on the right, but we know the Grand Nexus study is underway. This is the V1, and you're talking about V2 for San Mateo County.
Okay, yeah, 20. Yeah, those are probably quite dated already, you know. They generally only have an aged life of less than 5 years. But anyway, just wanted to kind of clarify that one. The hope is, by the way, that San Mateo County will get their updated housing feasibility analysis done by this fall. So, but that might be too late for this study. But maybe not as relevant either, because San Mateo housing prices are probably one of the highest in the Bay Area. Okay, let's see. Oh, I have a question regarding, I see for ownership housing, I see a 110 figure and 120% figure. So could you clarify for me, what is the proposal for setting the housing price versus the income qualification level? I ask that because some programs set the housing price at 110, but the household that can qualify for the unit can make up to 120% median income, and that allows for the additional costs for HOA dues, utility costs, and that kind of thing. So I see both the 120 in the staff report and the 110 in the, I think, consultant report. So what are we proposing to use as the basis for setting the housing price, 110 or 120?
I think you're picking up on our distinction there correctly, and we did talk about this in the working group, so you're probably remembering that, but we were proposing pricing at 110 and income at 120, just to give okay. you a little room there.
Yeah, good. That's kind of, that might want to clarify that in the ordinance to make sure that's understood. Okay, sorry, I'm just kind of going through my notes. Okay, I don't know. I have a comment, but I don't know what it was. Let's see. Okay, then I have a couple of general questions towards the end. Oh, one question I had was, maybe it's already in the ordinance, so it's not within the scope of what the consultant is being asked to do, but does our current ordinance have a requirement that the affordable units need to be comparable in unit mix to the market rate units? And are there criteria about the distribution of the units within the project? I assume that's the case, so that's why the consultant hasn't addressed those issues.
Yes, that's right. Brian and I were actually just talking before the meeting about how diligent our regulatory program is and making sure that that actually happens.
Oh, okay, good, good. And then I have a question regarding setting the rental housing at 10%. I understand the logic of it. I think in the committee meeting, there was a feeling is just maintain the current financial burden or liability for the developer, which is why once you eliminate the moderate, it drops it down to 10%. But when you looked at the survey of other cities, is most cities at 10% or 15% inclusion requirement for rentals? I know it varies depending on what their income requirements are.
Yeah, well, in Alameda County, most jurisdictions are actually at 15%. Steve can flip back to that slide somehow. Again, though, I know that this is reflecting data, right? This is the ownership. There you go. I know that most cities are a little bit cautious and needing to go look at their inclusionary now. They're cautious because this isn't a great market to be doing a feasibility study. You're probably very familiar with that through your work on the Grand Nexus as well as our committee. But some jurisdictions are considering a drop. I also caution folks to look at the six programs that are requiring 15% and seeing them as the same, because the actual financial implications of the different levels of affordability are quite meaningful. So they're not all just like hitting that bar, as it were. It's very easy to require 15% affordable, like in Union City, where the program is mostly mods or mostly low income. That's way more feasible than, say, a program like Hayward's, which is 5%, you know, is only like the lower income level, say.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's kind of apples and oranges, depending on what their income requirement is and then based on the economics of each city. Mm-hmm. Thanks. So those are my questions for now.
Thank you. Does anyone else have questions for staff or the consultant? Board Member Sue?
Thank you for the presentation. One question I had is just about the kind of cluster development approach. Is there anything in the ordinance that kind of guides that right now in terms of how that's supposed to be carried out, or has that just been carried out kind of like an ad hoc basis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty ad hoc. It depends on whether there's a development agreement sort of program involved where there's other sorts of negotiations going on as well about infrastructure, public facilities, and things like that, or if there's public land that is being swapped, say in the Tidelands. So there's a lot of variables in these clustered projects, as well as large plots like at Alameda Point.
Mm-hmm. And for these projects, is the kind of like, you know, if the developer's like providing land instance, is it been mostly, or like what's been kind of the mix of in terms of the land provided? Is it oftentimes like adjacent to the property they're developing on, or is it oftentimes like offsite somewhere else?
It's generally sort of on site in the grand scheme of things, but typically a separate parcel is created, and then a nonprofit developer takes the lead from there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear more about, you know, how much a commitment, I guess, the city is trying to get before they decide, like, oh, this is sufficient enough. And I think that's kind of some of the questions that the report raises. And I think some jurisdictions have written into their ordinance, like, in order to do a land swap or to have that kind of deal, you need to meet X, Y, and Z. And I think that's kind of what this report is getting at, but it'd be helpful to look at some of that. But I also kind of understand that, you know, sometimes you just don't,
you may not know enough, and it still might be good enough deal to go through with it. So I think there's a balancing of, like, you know, how much certainty do we want versus, you know, just being able to get the land and or whatever other benefits we're getting. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the consultant did try to estimate based on what we could glean from the Housing Authority, for instance, as a co-developer, sort of the land value and the cash contribution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Actually, just one question on that too is, the Housing Authority, is that something every city has? I always thought that was like a county agency, and I was always interested to see that the city has one. I don't know if you know any more about that and why the city specifically has one. I'm pretty sure some jurisdictions just don't have one. It's maybe because they don't manage affordable housing, and that might be the simple answer. Mm-hmm.
I don't know the whole history.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just add that it is unusual for a city to have its own housing authority. My experience has been that is generally an agency that lives in the county government. And then I just wanted to add on to Steve's comment about the offsite. There is a small provision in our existing ordinance that authorizes offsite construction according to the approval by the planning board. And there are some criteria, but it's a pretty modest provision. And you know, you may want to beef up those requirements either in the guidelines or in the ordinance itself.
And do you know off the top of your head how many kind of these cluster development deals the city has done, say, in like the last 10 years or so?
Well, it's a little complicated because this study that we're talking about here, just to clarify also, doesn't apply to Alameda Point because it has a settlement agreement that requires 25% inclusionary at a different program, and there's different land and infrastructure considerations there. But in terms of not on Alameda Point, I can think of, what, half a dozen?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, just another question I thought of. You know, kind of this discussion about ownership. I think it's the rental units that are having a hard time being rented out that are set to kind of mid-income because people would rather just go get a mid-income market rate unit. Do we have a lot of those that are still currently vacant? And is there a possibility to, like, change those to become low income because they've been vacant so long so that they can come to, you know, 80% AMI or 60% AMI just so that we can fill those units?
Well, it's an interesting idea. I guess it would probably be related to this study in terms of what's the equivalence of 7% mod versus, say, 4%. Low or some swap like that, but mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting idea.
Okay, and are you saying kind of to that idea is that if we did a swap, then like the developer might get some of those units back as market rate because now they're kind of offering those at like lower incomes, so they're not like that would be equivalent of them offering more moderate units. Is that kind of what you're kind of saying in terms of your comment just now?
I guess it would depend on what's the real subsidy that we're talking about per.
Right.
Unit. And we don't really have a provision in the ordinance for that, so we would need to, you know, sort of modify some approvals and you know, I guess it's doable.
Could be worth looking into if they're sitting around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can just add that some of our clients have provisions that say if you can't rent it at the rate, it's kind of the developer's responsibility to lower it. And what they can do is lower it when the market is low and then bring it back up to, say, 80 or 120 when that's possible and the unit is vacant. So there's lots of ways that people solve that conundrum. Their jurisdictions solve that.
Mm-hmm. Just one more question. When we talk about life of the project now, if we're saying it's going to be life of the project or 99 years, life of the project, I would assume, means until the building is, like, demolished? Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Forever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Forever. Yeah. However long that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. we would phrase it whichever is greater.
Whichever is greater. Yeah, I guess if the building is replaced, those entitlements would carry forward or be replaced. We'd have to see how that goes.
Yeah, well, when I was in private practice, developers would just joke, like, that's not my problem. Like, 99 years from now, they're long gone. So, and I think the report kind of hinted at that, too. They're thinking more
short-term.
And so, like, for them to say 50 versus 90, they're like, you know, whatever, the finances have already penciled out for me, so. Yeah.
Just a sidebar, I don't know if the 59 years was to avoid some sort of 60-year threshold on... it's as if you were an owner, if you have a 60-year lease on something.
Yeah, the rule against perpetuities, is
yes.
that what you're thinking
Yes,
of?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it applies to this particular area, but I know that cities are extending the requirement to 99 years, so I'm sure it's gone through legal review.
Great, yeah, thank you so much for those questions. Any other questions? No? Okay. My fellow board members got to some of the ones I were thinking about. I guess somewhat on theme to some of these questions brought up. I understand the recommendation, what is it for? The rental inclusion areas, the 4% and 6%. What would be the argument for the 100% AMI? Like, I think the report mentions something to the effect of there's folks that make too much money in order to qualify for subsidies, but don't make enough to afford the market rate rents. But I don't know, if I was wondering if either staff or the consultant could say a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that's exactly the trade-off. Mm-hmm. The 10% also at 5 and 5, maybe that's just easier math at VLI and LI, or the 4, 4, and 4, also just easy to remember. But also the 100% AMI, I think, is targeting just slightly lower, where we might actually have people that qualify and need the unit.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than 120.
Yeah.
I think there was some concern that that there might be households that are missed in the housing ladder if we didn't include a little bit of 100%. And, you know, a good next step would be to do some more robust market research or analysis of the housing element data to see if that's coming to pass. And I know the folks at Housing and Human Services had some households they had in mind, and so that's another place so that we could think more about if that decision, that information could be helpful to decision makers.
Along those lines, for the ownership column, mm-hmm. I did want to note that HHS staff did have a little bit of a reservation of just putting all our eggs in the moderate basket in this category, that they still do believe that there are some households at the lower income levels that can qualify and can carry the costs, the extra costs of homeownership, and benefit from that opportunity to have that stability and ownership.
You're saying that?
The health, what was it?
Housing and Human Services.
Housing and Human Services. Yeah.
It's a city. Department that enters into the regulatory agreements with the developers.
It'd be nice to get some data on that, because that's not what I'm hearing Bay Area-wide. Mm.
The 80% AMI?
Yeah, it's difficult for to get ownership candidates at that level.
And I believe that's what the housing element concluded as well, and that's why we're doing this study. But it's just, I just wanted to note that Simone did express this concern that
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm open if there's some valid financial analysis that shows that 80% households can actually afford to buy and maintain one of these units, and you know, it's a huge subsidy, you know, and that's the other argument: is it better to use those that huge subsidy for an 80% unit for, you know, say five low-income rental units, you know. So that's, I think we talked about that at the committee meeting.
Yeah, I think you hit that point really well. And, you know, when the report makes clear that for the ownership units, if you're, even for the moderate, you're subsidizing on the order of $500,000 for a single household that's getting the benefit of those ownership inclusionary units. And for a very low, you're up to potentially $900,000 sort of subsidy going to one household. And like you said, if you split that, take that as like an in-lieu fee and use that $900,000, the housing authority could potentially get 10 units for that, you know, same at a lower, at those same affordability levels.
That's an interesting, that would be like an interesting analysis to look at, just, to see the value of that and what the trade-offs are, I guess. That's helpful. And sorry, Mr. Buckley, you said, and the housing element demonstrated already that not many households at the 80% AMI necessarily.
I believe that was part of the discussion, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then my other question was, there was case making for the in-lieu fee to be calculated by square foot versus by unit. So I was just wondering what the logic was for the smaller projects to keep it at that per unit basis, the 9 units or less. Is it just because it's working, or?
I think fundamentally it was just not to upset the system. Kirsten, did you have more to add?
Oh, I was just gonna say, I mean, that isn't something that we discussed at length at the committee. There could be benefits to moving it over, but as Steve said, a lot of stakeholders get used to a certain way of calculating. But zooming out to why we're going to the per square foot basis. If it's a unit and a unit, then the size of the unit isn't captured. So a 3-bedroom unit and a 1-bedroom unit are contributing the same fee. And that's why we wanted to have it be more accurately tracking the value of the unit for the larger projects. For the smaller projects, we could look at that, the financial variations might be a little different, and the stakeholder group might feel slightly different about it, the development stakeholder group, that is.
Yeah, go ahead.
I might add a point on that. You know, under the new state law, you know, that was, I think, went into effect in 2023 for impact fees, which doesn't include inclusionary housing, cities are required to convert their per unit fee to square footage or some equivalent proportional. So I think it makes sense that for consistency, you know, the housing in lieu fees would kind of reflect a similar type of formula on a per square foot basis. And the argument I've heard is that it doesn't, by doing square foot, doesn't penalize the smaller units, you know, because under the per unit basis, a studio apartment would pay the same fee as, say, a 3-bedroom apartment. So it disincentivizes, at least for lieu fees, it disincentivizes the smaller units, which are sometimes highly needed for affordable housing purposes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's the argument I've heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like we're naturally moving into the discussion component of this workshop. So I kind of just wanted to open it up and...
if I may, need public comment.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
maybe we can interrupt your discussion with
public
comment.
Yeah, no worries. Of course. I'm like, oh, we have a little mojo here. Okay, thank you so much for answering our questions. And with that, do we have public comment?
Give folks a second if they want to raise their hand, but I do not believe we have any speakers on this item.
Nothing.
No speakers.
Okay. With that, we'll close public comment and we'll now move into discussion or feedback, reflections from the report. I don't know if anyone would like to start. Board Member Sahiba.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I appreciate the thorough presentation and very thorough report. I really think that as we look at this, and I know there's different, I appreciate that we're looking at multiple jurisdictions locally and nationwide on how to tackle this. It seems to me that when we looked at our housing element plan and really studied the different ways to increase housing and then affordability as something that we're focusing more on here, we should continue to engage with the developer community. And it's not a question, it's more just commentary that the different ways that we can help trigger the development of all these units, I mean, market rate and affordable, is figuring out, what things vary in the marketplace, of course, and things vary with the economy and other aspects that, are more global than local. And I would say that as we continue these discussions, I know that we've got, in the report cites that we've got projects in the pipeline that haven't yet come to materialize. I would say that, I don't know which agency in the city would spearhead this, but it would be good to understand what are the triggers that would help unlock some of the projects that have stalled, and if any policies that we're considering here, and moving percentages one way or the other, would start to have a bigger impact on that specific ability for us to produce this housing, obviously with developers who are ready to start moving on it. So I think all these trends are good from different jurisdictions and such. I think what would be good to influence a little bit more of our discussion is getting some good feedback from the development community, whether it's locally in our jurisdiction or adjacent jurisdictions, to see what's working. I mean, I will say this from my own experiences in different jurisdictions. There's definitely different triggers, whether it's the timeline it takes to develop, whether it's very clear strategies that are in place, or even various fees that are worked out and negotiated. And we are in a kind of influx time where I think the development community wants to get things moving, but are still held back a little bit just through policy discussions that haven't yet quite moved the needle in a direction that will unlock some of the stuff. So that's really my commentary, is I think the report can become a bit more multifaceted through the lens of looking at it from the actual people who will produce the housing. So thank you,
appreciate that. Any other board members? Board Member Sue?
So overall, I think staff and the consultant doing a great job. I agree with all the recommendations, the adjustment to income requirements based on current housing needs and market conditions, expanding availability of the in-lieu fee, also this criteria on clustered units, and then also the period of affordability. I'm amazed that just looking at the increase in the in-lieu fee from ownership, that would be under the proposal from $17.87 to 30 or 50, but it seems like based on the report that it would still make sense. I just thought that was interesting. It's such a big increase. There was some discussion, I think in the report, maybe just even now, about making ownership units where if you say you set it to 80% AMI affordability, that's how much the unit would cost, but you allow it up to anyone up to 120% AMI to purchase the unit. I think that's it's an interesting idea and concept that I think is worthy of kind of a little more discussion. I think there's this kind of discussion to be had about whether by doing that are you kind of effectively maybe shutting out some people who are more at the lower income at an 80% AMI, because now you have 120% AMI, you know, income folks who are competing with them. But then maybe you're just kind of making it that the unit, you know, available to more people and giving it more opportunity for someone to end up buying it. I will be interested in seeing, I think, the overall kind of clustered development, cluster units, to kind of see a little more of the language that comes out in terms of developing kind of more of the specific requirements. But I think that's definitely something worth exploring more. I had one more comment, but I can't remember it, so I'll stop for now. Thank you.
Thank you. And Board Member Hall?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, good report. And I generally agree with most of the recommendations. There are some areas that I would like to see a reconsideration, and I'll point out what those are. But first of all, I think the rental units I think the goal was to not incur a greater financial burden on developers at this time, since the finding is that projects are not feasible anyway, and it could be down the road when it could be reevaluated. But using that as the premise of not increasing the financial impact on developers, I like the 4% and 6%, the 10% figure that's comparable to the current ordinance. The reason why I like dropping the moderate rate units, because as the study concludes, you know, there's not much of a subsidy required for the moderate income rental units. Plus, I look at the housing element and the huge need for very low and low income units are critical in the city, and these rental units can certainly, it's not gonna solve the problem, but by emphasizing, placing priority on rental units in that category, I think is the right policy direction to go. For the ownership units, for economic reasons, I like the idea of like what most cities are doing of going towards moderate income households as the inclusion requirement to reduce the huge subsidy that's required. What I would like reconsideration is, I know that the $50,000 in lieu fee option is, you know, like triple what we currently have, but currently these projects, unless they're small projects, are not allowed to do inclusionary units. The concern I have with the $50,000 figure, which the consultant mentioned most cities keep it kind of equal, or for policy reasons they might provide some flexibility, but the $50 figure is like 20% or more below the 18% inclusion requirement. So what that tells me is developers are gonna do their math, and they're gonna more logically go with the lieu fee option, which it has its benefits because you can use it for clustered housing projects and et cetera. But then it kind of defeats or minimizes or disincentivizes the option for ownership, affordable ownership units. So I'm more inclined to say, try to keep the lieu fee option for the ownership units comparable or maybe at 10% less. Like for instance, if we go with the 20% inclusion requirement, maybe you set the in lieu fee at the 18% level. Otherwise, basically it's almost an illusion to have a 20% or 18% inclusion requirement when the lieu fee, basically you're reducing it by 20%, so you're only getting 15%. So to me, that's too much of a gap, and there's not gonna be an incentive to create ownership units, in my opinion. So from a policy standpoint, I could see trying to provide differential there, you know, but 20% seems like too big of a gap to me. Then I do have one question. What's the rush? I know the current in lieu fee calculated is 27. This is for rental units. I'm shifting. And in lieu fee is 27,500. But so what, or 20, is it 25? forgot what it was. Why are we suggesting increasing the in lieu fee to $35 per square foot? Because I'm thinking on the same line, would it be maybe desirable to keep it relatively equal so you can negotiate with the developers? There might be one project where you prefer the in lieu fees, another project where you want to increase the or make ensure there's inclusionary units. But when there's a disincentive within lieu fees in this case, then you know maybe from a policy standpoint, you really want to emphasize the inclusionary units within a rental project. Just kind of wonder why the rationale for the recommendation to make the in lieu fee much higher than the actual costs for producing an inclusionary unit for a rental project.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's basically a disincentive to pay the fee on rental units because they are being developed now and they're being rented successfully at those lower income levels. So the more we can get of those, the better. And
okay.
Then the fees could probably come in for those projects where that's just how it works out better for them.
Okay. That makes sense. I'm just kind of wondering why that's the case. And then some general comments. I mentioned before, I like exploring the shared equity model, especially if you are going to increase the affordability term for ownership units to 99 years. You know, maybe, you know, I know it gets more complex, but maybe the shared equity can phase in after an owner owns a unit for, you know, say 20 years or so, because there's been an argument that you're perpetually keeping that household in a subsidized condition because they're not going to have enough equity in their home to move up to a market rate unit unless there's some equity. And the whole point is to try to improve upward mobility, like all of us benefit from the equity we build up in our home. So having affordable households somehow have a shared equity model. And it's not necessarily 100% or zero. Some cities do this 50-50 or some percentage share. So it'd be good to kind of look into that. I do agree with the comment about having maybe the need for greater criteria for clustering, the clustered option, you know, maybe, you know, the unit size or what is considered a comparable cluster development if you're using, say, ownership in lieu fees to produce, say, equivalent rental units, you know, it's not a one-to-one type of ratio. So some criteria for that. And I like the suggestion that the consultant put in the report about needing to demonstrate development feasibility for a cluster option, because I've been in cases where a site is dedicated to the city and it sits there for many years because you can't get the funding to develop the cluster option. And then unfortunately, with at least the next couple of years, it looks like federal funding for affordable housing projects are going to be curtailed significantly. So it's even more important that a cluster option is proved to be financially feasible somehow, get demonstrated. What some cities also consider locational criteria, that the clustered housing needs to be within the same general neighborhood or region, so you can't just suddenly do a clustered housing project, you know, across, you know, put them all in, like, say, West Alameda, say, you know. So having some criteria about where they're located relative to the project might be something to consider. I don't know, maybe that becomes too restrictive, but something to consider. But generally, the idea of having some criteria for the clustered housing makes sense. I like the idea of the flexibility was kind of raised about, you know, if there are vacant units, you know, requiring the developer to rent them out, even if it requires them to lower the rent somewhat so that they're not sitting on a vacant unit. Two other things, I know it's outside the scope of what the developer, what the consultant has, the scope of their work, But and this may already be covered in the city's housing inclusion ordinance, but whether there's a preference requirement for these units, you know, I know there's fair housing requirements need to be carefully considered. So usually it's just a more of a marketing kind of situation, trying to provide preference to residents that already live in Alameda or work in Alameda. So that might already be in the ordinance. I don't know. I'm just bringing that up. And then bringing up a final thing is under another new state law that came up is that for most residential projects, they qualify to allow their fees to be paid at occupancy. I don't know when the city collects the inclusionary fees, but new state law for many residential, probably most residential projects says you can only collect it at occupancy stage now. And that also, I think projects that qualify under SB 330, the fees are locked in at pre-development stage. You know, so somehow having those parameters probably need to be spelled out in the updated ordinance. So those are my comments, but I think there are really good progress on this report. So I appreciate the information today.
Thank you. Thank you to my fellow board members for those great comments and looking through the report and the feedback. And thank you to the staff and consultant for bringing this to us and having some great information to think through. And I'm in agreement with a lot of the comments already made. I'm generally in agreement with the recommendations put forward. And I do appreciate both the comments made about zooming out and just thinking about what's the intended outcome of this, and which is to have more housing units, have more affordable housing units. So I just really appreciate fellow board members bringing that up. And yeah, I guess just maybe parsing through some of the things that some of the themes that were brought up with the rental inclusionary. I would be interested in having more analysis on what bumping it up to the 100% AMI, 4% at MOD. Although, again, I am leaning towards what the consultant already recommended. I think it is going to be important, I think, for us to consider the framing of this, because it maybe doesn't look politically great dropping from 15% to 10% without explaining, like, hey, this is dropping the AMI households that don't really require that subsidy. So we're prioritizing these households that really would benefit from this program. So that's just something for us, I think, to think about as we move forward in this process. And plus one on maybe more information on what this cluster recommendation is putting forward. Like I almost like feel like I need like some examples, like what are the potential criteria pieces that we would want to think about, because it does seem like it is working pretty well and it is a helpful tool for our housing authority. So just seeing how this fits into this larger piece of the pie when it comes to the in-lieu fees and the inclusionary. I'm just curious about just a little bit more on this cluster recommendation. Yeah, I think those are all my comments, and I also appreciate the suggestions of like maybe some regulatory fixes or not fixes, but analysis, for example, offering the units at a lower rate when it's not renting out, so on and so forth. So just appreciate all those insights. Yeah, so I think those are all my comments. And yeah, thank you again to staff, the consultant, and my fellow board members for all your perspectives.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. So as I mentioned, we will be coming back to you in the relatively near future, I hope, with a little bit more of a real sort of ordinance, perhaps with some options built into the text, and we'll also be responding to your comments and discussion today. So thank you.
Great. And did you have any like follow-up or clarifying questions for us before we wrap up, or no? You got it all. Okay.
No,
you're a great note taker. So.
No, I think that was all very helpful. Good questions and good suggestions. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. And with that, we'll go ahead and close this agenda item. And we'll move on to, I guess, sorry, I got confused with some of these adjustments made. 5C, or the use permit item, that's being continued.
Right. Yes, 5C, the temporary use permit is continued off calendar. We'll notice that when it's ready to be heard.
Okay, great. So we'll go ahead and
the IP is next, right?
Close that. Do we?
Yeah, they voted.
I think so, Paul.
So,
yeah. Okay.
Okay. Do we need to open it up for public comment or anything? No?
No.
Okay. All right. Moving on. Thank you. That closes our regular agenda items. And then we'll move on to staff communications.
Yes, as usual, item 6A, you have a page in your packet that lists the projects that were recently approved at the staff level. You have three design review applications that are routinely delegated to staff. Those are in their appeal period. And item 6B, I don't really have anything to report. Yeah, I'll just mention, we are gonna be meeting at your next regular meeting for a use permit modification.
Okay. The Encinal Terminal?
Oh, no, and that would be for the, a gas station at on Central Avenue.
Okay, got it. Great. Any comments? If not, open up for a public comment.
We have no speakers.
Okay, we'll close public comment. Great, thank you for staff communications report. Any board communications? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and any public comment on that? Nope. All right, closing that item. Non-agenda public comments. If anyone would like to speak about an item that was not agendized tonight, may do so now for 3 minutes. Seeing none, we'll close that. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.